Welcome back to the program. 50 years ago this week, the world awoke to the death of Marilyn Monroe. At her death, she was already one of the most well-known Americans of the 20th century. In death, she would become even more famous, steeped in mythology and contradiction, as she would become a symbol of mid-century American ideas. Anais Nin once said that we don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. This was particularly true for Marilyn, who saw the world through the lens of her own dysfunction, which gave her a particularly unique perspective on the role of women in post-war America. My guest, Lois Banner, has written a new book about Marilyn, which reveals a deep and complicated woman, full of contradiction and complexity, rooted in an unstable childhood and accentuated by the realities of Hollywood. Lois Banner is a founder in the field of women's history and co-founder of the Berkshire Conference of Women Historians. She was the first woman president of the American Studies Association and is the author of 10 previous books, including American Beauty. She's a professor of history and gender studies at USC, and it is my pleasure to welcome Lois Banner here to talk about Marilyn, the passion and the paradox. Lois Banner, thanks so much for joining us.
I'm very happy to be here.
Good to have you here. One of the things that sort of comes across in a larger sense is this way in which Marilyn was a kind of almost Gatsby-esque figure, that she had this ability to kind of change and shape her personality to whatever the circumstances were. And in many ways, that was as a result of her youth. Talk a little about that.
Oh, sure. Marilyn suffered from some variation on a bipolar condition. One hates to psychoanalyze her after the fact. I make the argument that she had disassociated because of a very difficult childhood and also sexual abuse that was visited on her during her childhood. And experts say such abuse can often create almost a multiple personality. Not exactly that. That whole definition has changed, but something called disassociation. She was many people, not just one person. And as many great figures in history, the bipolarity in her character, the up-down moods that she went through actually helped to create her genius. Virginia Woolf had such a problem, as, and the most famous example historically of a bipolar genius is George Gordon Lord Byron. Byron also had a bad bipolar situation. It's not uncommon for such a condition to occur. And in Marilyn's case, it both made her a very melancholic, depressive person, but it also... She also could easily go into the manic phase, the hypomanic phase between the two, which is when psychologists believe the great creativity occurs, so that she had both. She had the deficiencies of this condition, but she also had the advantages of this condition.
And in fact, in many ways, her condition was both the best and the worst for Hollywood. It was the worst possible place for her, given her weaknesses. And in many ways, those same weaknesses helped her gain success in Hollywood.
Yeah, that is true. There was a lot of frenzy in Hollywood as well, and a lot of depression in Hollywood as well. Marilyn, you know, I call her a genius in the book, and I think that she was very intelligent, very clever, very shrewd. She had an aesthetic kind of mind, which made her sometimes appear not all that intelligent, in the sense that she saw things in aesthetic terms. She wasn't always logical in the way she would present an argument. But behind it all was a shrewd understanding of human nature, an amazing ability to project herself, a superb ability to really everybody liked her, except for certain key figures in Hollywood who didn't. But on the other hand, she made her career herself. She knew how to go to the best teachers. She went to the best publicists. She had them behind her. It was Marilyn, ultimately, who created her image and created her multifaceted self.
Where did she learn how to do that? In effect, she was ahead of her time with respect to creating her own brand.
Well, there's some truth to this. It wasn't unusual in Hollywood for people who were on the way up to try to do this. Marilyn just had a particular genius at doing it. Early on, she hooked up with Sidney Skolsky, who was a very major columnist in Hollywood and who dated back to the days of Jean Harlow and the 30 stars. He helped Marilyn to put together the persona that she became. It was simply a situation in which she looked around her, saw what was happening, was very shrewd about how she could make herself into a star. She was a failure for something like 6 years in Hollywood. She tried to be a girl next door look, a sweet little girl, which was a very popular look in the late 40s and early 50s, and it didn't work. She didn't get anywhere with that particular look. And then she began realizing that the newspapers and the trade journals were all calling for the need for a new sex symbol on the order of Jean Harlow. Marilyn knew that innately she radiated a tremendous glow and charm that could be seen as sexual, and so she created herself as the greatest sex symbol in Hollywood, and it worked. It worked. She did take over that position, and Hollywood then, put her into leading roles because of it.
Who did she see, if anyone, as her competition?
Well, Elizabeth Taylor eventually. Mm-hmm. Marilyn was not a terribly competitive person. She saw Elizabeth Taylor as her great competition eventually.
Talk about that. Ultimately, her relationship with Elizabeth Taylor.
She once said to a friend of hers that, look, Elizabeth Taylor wasn't much when she began in Hollywood, and they gave her all these starring roles and put her into dramatic parts. After Marilyn became the blonde bombshell, so-called, they wouldn't put her into dramatic roles. And more than anything else, she wanted to be a dramatic actress. She wanted to be on stage. She wanted to be Grushenka in The Brothers Karamazov. Those were her goals. They were dramatic goals. And Elizabeth Taylor, who had begun just as a little girl next door, they had put into the dramatic roles. And she was very annoyed that that had happened, because she felt she too should go into those particular roles. And then in the end, in 1962, Marilyn had vaguely wanted the lead role in Cleopatra, which went to Elizabeth Taylor, and then Marilyn felt quite competitive to Elizabeth Taylor. And then when Elizabeth Taylor did a sort of semi-nude shot for Vogue magazine, Marilyn, who was making Something's Got to Give, did a much more nude series of photos in a swimming pool.
Mm-hmm.
So she was trying to outdistance Elizabeth Taylor. But mostly Marilyn was really nice to women who might be seen as her competitors. Mm-hmm. She had a tremendously kind and generous streak. She became very friendly with Betty Grable, whom the fan magazines were billing as an enemy. She became very friendly with Jane Russell, became a close personal friend after they did Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, and the fan magazines were very confused because they wanted to make a huge fight between those two stars. The fan magazines loved to have controversies between female stars. They would relish that. But it was hard to get anything from Marilyn, because aside from the Elizabeth Taylor which was very private, it's hard to even recognize that it was going on until that 1962 Cleopatra episode.
Mm-hmm. Did she understand the inherent contradiction between creating herself as this sex symbol of the time and wanting to play serious roles, and the way in which Hollywood couldn't get its head around both ideas at the same time?
Oh, she surely understood the contradictions. She did not want to be that sex pot anymore. So in late 1954, she went to New York, and she started studying serious dramatic acting at the Actors Studio in New York. She wanted to give up the sex pot image, and the curiosity and sadness about Marilyn is that she couldn't. I hate to say that psychologically he had taken her over, but you know, actors and actresses will talk about the fact that they get into a role so much they can't get it out of themselves. And that's part of the reason she was in psychoanalysis. But, yeah, she went to the actor's studio and wanted to be able to do dramatic roles. But then, of course, the next thing she did is she had founded her own production company to make her own films. And then under the production company, first she did Bus Stop, and she was brilliant in that, and it was a partially dramatic role. And then she went into Prince and the Showgirl. And in both of those films, she was playing the chorus girl showgirl type, although I tell you, in neither film is she really a dumb blonde.
Mm-hmm.
She's smart in both films.
Talk a little bit about her relationships with Hollywood, the way she set about trying to get what she wanted, in some way somewhat ahead of her time.
Oh, I don't know. It's a hard one to guess. You know, she was such a contradiction. Everything's a paradox. She was, many people said she was the shyest person with the least self-reliance they'd ever seen, and others say she was strong and very, very tough. So what she did was anything she could do to get ahead. She slept with producers. She hounded producers. She learned to be a fabulous makeup artist by spending time around the makeup artists in the studios. She knew she couldn't act when she first came to Hollywood. She'd been a failure in high school plays. So she went to some of the best dramatic coaches and singing teachers and dancing teachers in Hollywood. And she worked. She was very poor. She spent all of her money, her limited income, on lessons. So, in a sense, she was a model for anyone coming after her because of the extraordinarily hard work and devotion that she put into all facets of her career. When a movie like Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, which every actress in Hollywood wanted, came up, Marilyn was ready because she had been trained by some of the best teachers in Hollywood in various areas of dramatic and movement arts, and she could do it all. She has a lovely singing voice. She moves very well on stage. Her acting is fine, and she created this. She created many characters, but the greatest character was her comic clown, which was an epic character she created. I call that person Lorelei Lee, which was Marilyn's name in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes.
Talk about that ambition and where that ambition came from with her, because it was in part ambition. It was also part the kind of workaholic attitude that came from these manic cycles that she had.
She was a workaholic. And probably they were related to some of her mania. A couple of her friends said they had never seen anyone with as much energy and drive as Marilyn had when she was up. And it did enable her to work constantly and to work very hard. It's been much too much stressed that she had depressive episodes, which she did have. Her characteristic pattern was twofold. First, she cycled really fast. In other words, in any given day, she could cycle up, down, down, up in 15 minutes or half an hour. But she also, when bad things happen to her, she could become very depressed, and she would go to bed 2-3 days, stay in bed, but she always managed to get up and always managed then to go back and to continue struggling on her way to success. The studios were really, really hard on their actors and actresses at this point in time. They had to be on the set, or I'd have to be at the studio at 5 in the morning. They start shooting at 7. They sometimes shoot till late in the night. They're back the next morning very early. So lots and lots of actors and actresses were taking pills to go to sleep, and they were taking pills to keep them awake during the day because they had to look fresh during shooting. And then she would do interviews when she had a break during shooting, interviews at lunch, at dinner. She had more requests for interviews than any other star in Hollywood at her time. And she was so determined to succeed that she tried to honor all the requests.
Talk about the spiritual side of her that you write about.
Oh, yeah, that's another unknown part about Marilyn that I discovered that really, it surprised me and really interested me. Yeah, she'd been raised in an evangelical church, and evangelicals have a lot of spirituality in their belief system, and then she was into Christian Science. And Christian Science also has a belief that God permeates the universe and you need to meet, you know, to find God, to make yourself into a contented person. When she got to Hollywood, she became interested in Rudolf Steiner's doctrines of anthroposophy, and she followed that for a while. She was always looking for a higher force that could guide her and help her. Her major acting teacher, Michael Chekhov, was the one who brought her into the Steiner belief system, which she did practice with the mystical dances they did for not long, a little while. And then she talked to Jane Russell about spirituality. The conversations with Jane Russell, which nobody has paid attention to, are really quite fascinating because Russell's a very intelligent woman too, and they would debate spirituality and spiritual systems. Russell was a very deeply Christian, and Marilyn always had an edge of Christianity to her belief system. Anthroposophy is a Christian creed at base. Finally, in the last years of her life, she converted to Judaism. And the rabbi who she did the conversion with, in his memoirs, which just recently became available, said it was not on her part anything. It was true. She really, truly did want to become involved with the religion. It wasn't simply that she was marrying Arthur Miller. She liked Jewish traditions that were connected around the family. She liked the mystical strain in Judaism, which is there. She liked the emphasis on the Bible and the laws. She really did have a way that she was connected to this. And she discussed spirituality with, of all people, the man at Madame Brenna's facial shop in Hollywood who gave her skin treatments. He was very versed in spirituality, and when she came to see him once a week for her treatment, they would talk about spiritual texts and leaders.
Who did she trust? There's this overwhelming sense that even with all of her success, that there was this deep-seated loneliness that she had.
Well, the curious thing about the deep-seated loneliness is that it's probably a part of her psychological issues, because she had many, many friends, many. I tracked them down. At some points, my book becomes a list of Marilyn Monroe's friends, because there were so many, and there were many women as well as men. She would call her friends if she was, you know, she saw terrible visions in her dreams. And if she was feeling lonely late at night, because she didn't sleep much, I mean, she had terrible insomnia, so she would call her friends late at night, and she had a whole long list of people that she would call, and that they would soothe her and try to calm her down. So the loneliness, I think, is part of her psychological situation. Also, I think anyone that's famous will say, but particularly if you try to become famous as she did, to gain love, to have people love you, they'll say you go home at night if you don't have a husband and a family. You go home at night to loneliness.
Talk a little bit about her mentors. Who did she look up to?
Oh, she was brilliant at finding mentors. If I had my life to do over again, I'd do what she did. She found mentors. She found really important people who could train her, who could help her. Her first was Josh Gank, who was the aging founder at Fox Studios, and he and Marilyn developed a very close relationship. One of his friends said, when she came into his house, he was then in his 80s, his face would like light up because she was so joyful and so tender and so loving that Joe Skank had a huge affection for her. He helped her a lot in Hollywood to know what she ought to do and to understand the difficult relationships in Hollywood. Another mentor was Johnny Hyde. He was probably the most prominent agent in Hollywood with William Morris, and he really helped her career. He loved her. She had an affair with him, and He was the one who told her to pattern her crown after Charlie Chaplin. He helped her a lot with how to position and pattern herself. He had brought Rita Hayworth and Lana Turner to fame. He had mentored them to fame. So he really knew what he was doing. There was Natasha Lyttes, who was her first acting coach. I happen to be much more favorably disposed to Natasha than many other people who think she was harsh and unyielding. I think she really helped Marilyn to be able to take on all the parts that Marilyn did. And there are many others. Michael Chekhov, Jack Cole, the greatest mime of the 20th century, Lottie Goslar, trained her in her clown, in her dumb blonde clown character. And there are others. The list is very long. She had a particular ability to identify potential mentors and then to charm them into wanting to help her.
You talk about her as kind of an early feminist. Talk about what you mean by that.
Well, this is a hard point to make, but I see it there, and I'm influenced by her friend Norman Rosten, who talks about this in his memoir. First of all, she thought of herself as a career woman, and she was interested in issues of promotion and pay and getting ahead. She fought for herself before the Hollywood moguls. They were tough men after the, you know, bottom line was a lot of money, and so she instructed her agents and did it herself to fight with them. She formed her own production company to control her career, and that was very unusual for a woman to do in Hollywood in that period. So these were all things she did, and she fought the moguls to a standstill. She won. They were attempting to fire her. They tried to fire her on her last film, Something's Got to Give. And she fought back. She fought back for actually before the public in the columns in the newspapers, in the fan magazines, and the fan mail was overwhelmingly in her favor. And so the moguls listened to that, and they reinstated her and gave her a large salary. They raised her salary from $100,000 a movie to $1 million a movie, which was what Elizabeth Taylor was making in Cleopatra. So she got all these things in what one would have to say was a direct confrontation with men. There wasn't a feminist movement then. She couldn't, you know, join anything really. But she on many occasions she spoke about, she was ambivalent about men, both drawn to them, loved them on the one hand, and on the other hand, felt that she was treated badly by them. Finally, what I think is very important is that she publicly named the sexual abuse visited on her. It was unheard of in the 1950s to do that because the victims of sexual abuse were considered responsible for the abuse. But she did it. She openly talked about it, and that was something that feminists did in the 1970s. It was part of their opposition to abuse on against women. They would name sexual abuse if it had been visited on them, and so Marilyn was kind of a precursor to that, too.
She had a very fragile sense of her mental health. In fact, you talk about the fact that she was always worried that she might go insane. Talk about that and the way it influenced her.
It's true. Unfortunately, her mother had a breakdown, was diagnosed as paranoid schizophrenic, and was put into a California state mental institution. Now, those mental institutions at that point in time were weakly funded, and they were filled with poor people, old people, people who were in the final stages of syphilis, which destroys the cells in the brain, etc. So her mother went into this situation, which is vividly pictured in the movie Snake Pit. And if her mother had been ill to begin with, it was only made worse in these hospitals. So she was diagnosed as having a disintegrating brain. In those days, mental illness was considered to be absolutely inheritable. So Marilyn was brought up to believe that she might inherit her mother's mental illness and that her brain might begin to disintegrate. As a result of which, Marilyn often would do outrageous things, take outrageous action, and then she would say, in her inimitable style, as a working class girl, life is short, so what the hell? In other words, then she could do whatever she wanted because she probably wasn't going to live that long anyway. It was really sad, the diagnosis of her mother. She was in psychoanalysis for significant portions of her adult life. Some people argue that it kept her going, that otherwise she also would have gone into deep mental disturbance. Others will argue that the psychoanalysis was the wrong therapy for her. I in fact believe the latter to be the case, not the former.
What more?
I believe it was probably the wrong. The most popular therapy in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. Freud was considered to be the savior of the world. Everybody was in psychoanalysis who had money.
What more did you uncover in terms of her relationship with the Kennedys?
That's a very dark portion of her life. I was, and hard to determine, I was given the great advantage of access to Anthony Summers' interviews. Anthony did his book in the early 1980s before people had clammed up. By the time I got to a lot of people, they would tell me things. I talked to a lot of the people around the Peter Lawford Circle. They would tell me things, but they would clam up on matters. But they weren't doing so with Tony Summers. So I got a lot out of his work. I also got some information from the surfers who had been down at Santa Monica Beach. Someone I had known as a graduate student turned out to be one of the major lifeguards on the Santa Monica Beach, and he introduced me to the old surfers. And I was able to determine through them that Marilyn had been attached to Peter Lawford and through Peter Lawford to the Kennedys much earlier than a lot of biographers have suggested. I also found through Summers' work, his interviews, that she had met Jack Kennedy in her early days in Hollywood at the home, Charles Feldman's home. Feldman was a major playboy who kind of was a center of one of the circles of party girl and party boy behavior. That's what they called it. In other words, light sexuality, etc. And Marilyn was one of the party girls in Hollywood in the early years. And so, given the fact that Hollywood was a small place and that Jack, the father of the Kennedy boys, had been the owner of a studio and in Hollywood for a certain periods of time, Jack Kennedy was there. He met many, many film stars. He almost married Jean Turney. He definitely met Marilyn Monroe, and given his way, it's certain in my mind that he bedded her. But there were occasional lovers. I don't think it ever became a big thing except in Marilyn's mind. She made it into much more than it actually was, and she particularly did that after Arthur Miller died. Mm-hmm. She was just in very bad shape after Arthur Miller died. Died after she divorced Arthur Miller. Mm-hmm. She was in very bad shape. And so she was making a lot of assumptions about the men she was dating that really weren't true. To the Kennedys, she was a playgirl. Look, what they really loved about her was the fact that she was not only very cheerful and very sexy, but she was very funny. She had a native wit that was quite substantial. She made puns and jokes all the time. She could keep people just, you know, in stitches because she could be so funny. So some of the Kennedy involvement with her was based on the fact that she could lighten your spirits and make you feel good about yourself.
What more do we know now about her death?
Well, it's slowly being pieced together, I believe. Some people are absolutely certain she died of a an accidental overdose. But then there's the curious fact that she'd been careful to have 50 pills of Nebutol in her possession, and that would be enough to kill her. But there was even more than 50 pills in her system, which makes me suspicious. We know that there's a whole series of phone calls. I won't go into it. We know that there were people in her house the night she died. We know that the minute that she died, representatives of the studio, her lawyer was there, her doctors were there. They tried to revive her. An ambulance may have been called. People saw, and people saw Bobby Kennedy at her house that day. So we know that there was a great deal of activity going on that entire Saturday and then that night too. And once she was found dead, once the housekeeper found her dead, then all the people came over and they removed all the incriminating evidence from her file cabinets, which were broken into eventually, and whatever letters from the Kennedys, letters, any letter, substantial letter regarding the studio was all taken that night.
What is your conclusion about her death?
You know, I am a professional historian. I don't make conclusions unless I'm completely certain about the evidence. I'm completely certain about the cover-up to hide the relationship with the Kennedys. About the death itself, I'm about 75% certain that she was killed. But there's a margin of error in my mind. She had the kind of manic depressive syndrome, unfortunately, that could go into suicidal thoughts very easily. That is a true form. You can have that form where you very easily go into suicide. There, she had OD'd a number of times that summer, and had to be, doctors called or taken someplace to get her stomach pumped. So that there's the 25% margin of error. But one thing that's interesting about her situation is she didn't drink any liquor. There wasn't any liquor in her stomach.
Talk about, finally, somebody that was photographed as much as she was. How did you choose this photo for the cover?
Well, I wanted to have a soft photo of her, one that showed her as vulnerable and sweet. That is the Marilyn underneath. I didn't want a glamour photo where she is the made-up Marilyn Monroe. I wanted the true person. And I also wanted a colored photo on the cover because I think that's softer and gentler. And this photo is by Sam Shaw, and his daughters are close friends of mine. So I wanted to honor Sam, who had such a wonderful impact on Marilyn, whom she knew very well and who was a very close friend of hers. Then if you will look at the beginning of the prologue, I have the photo of Marilyn on the grate, the very famous photo with the skirt flying up.
Right.
And that's a glamour photo and a photo showing her as a sexual person. And Sam Shaw took that photo also. So I like the juxtaposition of those two Marilyns.
Lois Banner, the book is Marilyn, The Passion and the Paradox. It's just out from Bloomsbury. Lois, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, it was my pleasure. I enjoyed it a lot.
Thank you.